So they say that this is a threat.
Yes.
So what we have to do, we have to weaken these countries to the level that they cannot be any possible threat for Israel.
Yes.
So the agenda is there, always on the table, trying to cause troubles and problems for the countries, weakening them, dividing them.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Praises to Allah, all glory is to Allah, we worship Allah and no one but Allah.
But beside that, the superpowers in the world, I mean the imperialists and the colonialists in the world, need a puppet or a proxy land for their attacks to the other regions. In the Middle East, is namely Israel, is one of them. Because they say, okay, this was the land of the Jews, so they have to get back to their own lands. And they were not satisfied with giving them a piece of land in the Europe, okay, where they belong to.
Yeah, actually, they're being puppet for the West. That is the nature. I didn't talk about it because that is the nature of that state. Yes. So sometimes you need to have the puppet to serve, to control, to have a surveillance. But it is more than that. They just, as long as they say sometimes, oil is there, the problem in the Middle East will continue.
Yes.
So, I mean, they use Israel. An Israeli plan is that, of course, when we say Israel, as you said, Israel is not only that limited, small, you know, group of people and a racial or religious group. You know, there is a big agenda behind it, and you see that all the Western superpower, Western countries are there. Because this is part of the representative of America and the West in the region. So in that plan that I said, in the added Yenon's plan, it is very well explained that how they are going to divide the countries in the region. Uh-huh. And this is the agenda.
Yes.
In 1991, we had a book written by James Black.
Yes.
The book is Thunder in the Desert, the strategy and tactics of the Persian Gulf War. In this book, which is written in 1991, James Black, who is a researcher and director of the Deputy Chief of Staff Strategic Deterrence and Nuclear Integration Headquarters of U.S. Air Force in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
This man, when he talks about the region, in 1991, he talks about the... You remember there was an animation, a cartoons by the name The Adventures of Gulliver.
Yes.
Gulliver was a man, you know...
An adventurer.
Happening to visit a land of the elves, you know, small people.
The dwarves, that's right, the elves.
Yeah.
Right.
So there are small people, and this man is like a giant to them.
Yes.
And so there are lots of stories going around. And so... He referring to the story of the Gulliver, he says that Israel is in the region and there are some Gullivers. There are six, actually, he says there are six Gullivers in the region, which are Iran, Iraq, Israel, Egypt, Syria, and Turkey. Egypt, Israel is mentioned considering the power, not the geography.
Yes.
So he says that there are six countries that they can be the players, the Gullivers of the region. Then he says, what we have to do, we have to shrink those others to the interest of Israel. So they all will be elf, and there will be only one Gulliver in the region, and that is Israel.
Yes.
So you see that in the adventure of Gulliver, there is Gulliver and the elves who were always worried about the other, you know, elves who are fighting them.
Yes.
Then he says that there are also some worried countries in the region, that they are those worried elves. And it is Kuwait, Tunisia, Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, and Jordan. So these countries are always worried about the big Gullivers to attack them.
Yes.
And what we have to do is to make them concerned about those Gullivers. So we have to always create attention
yes.
there. Then the small elves are afraid of the Gullivers neighboring yes. them.
Okay.
Then he explains that about Emirates, we have to always raise the issue of the three islands between them and Iran. So the tension is always there. Kuwait should be worried about Iraq. So, Jordan and Saudi Arabia, they have tensions. And Tunisia and Egypt and Libya. These yeah. should be engaged always. So they're always concerned. So, I mean,
that's right.
At that time, they talk about these the strategy of shrinking the yes. countries again, the continuation of the Adad Yunus plan in a different terming.
And it has nothing to do with the Islam being the religion of peace.
So you see, it has nothing to do. I mean, yes. these are the geopolitical things on the ground. It has nothing to do with Islam. This book is written in 1991. In 1993, Shimon Peres, you know, Shimon Peres was at that time was the president
yes.
Israel. So he wrote a book, The New Middle East. Mm-hmm. In that New Middle East, he very well explains that what they expect from the Middle East to be in the coming years. Means dividing them and having the full control of the whole Middle East. And you see, in 2001, we have the story of the World Trade Towers and uh-huh. that story, started occupying the countries, Afghanistan and Iraq.
Iraq by finding biochemical
yeah,
weapons,
yeah, yeah.
which was not
always
found.
Excuses are. Yeah. I said excuses are always yes. there, and later on, you know, it was exposed that you know some high staff army like Wesley Clark, they came later on to yes. speak that. They told us we have to occupy 7 countries in 5 years.
Yes.
So there was an agenda. That's why lots of people believe that even that the events were sort of made by the Americans yes. themselves.
Yes.
So they were behind everything.
Okay. We know that the religion of Islam is the religion of peace, but based on the teachings of the Holy Quran, Prophet Muhammad, it defends itself. I mean, against the enemies of Islam. I mean, always the strategy has been defensive and not aggressive. This is the main difference.
No. I don't want to get into that concept uh-huh. because it has nothing to do with Islam, I said.
Okay.
It's nothing with Islam. It is just the rationality. Rationality yes. is that you have to defend yourself. So I don't think any position we have here to speak about Islam and Islamic approach towards war or peace. It has absolutely nothing with Islam.
Yes.
You know, from 2010, we have the Arab Spring yes. raising. And then at that time, Americans raised the issue of the greater Middle East.
Yes.
Now, there was an analysis by the name Rabin.
Yes.
Rabin B. Wright.
Yes.
They introduced her as an American foreign affairs analyst, but she's more than that.
Yes.
When she introduced the new plan and map of the Middle East, you see that Iran is divided into 5 countries. Okay. Iraq is divided into some countries.
Yes.
And all these countries are divided. Then they raised the idea of the 30 years religious war.
Mm-hmm.
So they said that the plan was that to raise a kind of Shia-Sunni war in the region.
Yes.
And Shia-Sunni, they will kill each other to the extent that all people will be tired of Islam.
Okay.
This is exactly the same story that happened in the West some 100 years ago, 200 to 300 years ago, when the Catholics and Protestants, yes. they started killing each other for 30 years, and people were tired of religion. Then they accepted secularism.
Establishment of ISIS was one of them.
So the ISIS, you see that today yes. ISIS is what ISIS. There was a terrorist attack in
yes.
Kerman, and after 2-3 days, ISIS comes to accept the responsibility. It means that now ISIS is the puppet
yes.
for Israel in
yes.
the region to do their dirty job
yes.
and to accept the responsibility for that.
Okay.
So you see that as long as Israel is there, there is no peace. And for the peace, Israel, exactly the term is right, that Israel is the cancerous.
That's right.
Land in the region that
okay.
it has nothing to do with any religion. Anyone who wants peace, they have to get rid of issue. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Agha Mohammadi, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic, Islam, the religion of peace, and what is the problem of the Muslims, in true sense of the word, with Israel, especially the Zionist in today's world. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روبا شابت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Kuwait, a key player in the global oil market, has recently experienced a significant setback in its petrol exports to Europe, with a staggering 43% decline, according to a recent S&P report. This decrease is mainly caused by escalating pressure on ship owners to steer clear of the Red Sea, which has seen an exchange of fire between American and Yemeni forces in recent days. The situation escalated after the US-UK alliance airstrikes on Yemen earlier this month. The two countries claim they acted to protect international shipping from Yemeni attacks. This is while attacks by Yemenis are only aimed at Israeli vessels or vessels moving toward the Israeli-occupied territories. They say this is a targeted effort to apply pressure on Israel to move towards an urgent ceasefire in Gaza.
The attack of Yemeni fighters on Israeli ships is a natural reaction to pressure countries that support Israel to stop their support, while also demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. If the attack on Yemen continues, the resistance will continue to respond, and this could get bigger.
This situation has especially hurt Europe significantly, impacting its imports of refined petroleum products in the first half of January. European supply chains are already strained, experiencing delays, increased shipping costs, and potential financial losses for businesses dependent on the Red Sea route. It appears that Europe's steadfast support for Israel has had severe repercussions for the continent itself.
The Yemeni fighters target only Israeli vessels and those which are going to Israel. The alternative is taking another route from Ras Raja Saleh. This transfer takes 15 days or more with higher costs. These factors in the short run will cause inflation. Economists warn of a domino effect that could eventually hit European consumers harder than the inflation of 2022 during the Russia-Ukraine conflict. They warn Europe may face higher energy costs and delayed shipments, leading to an economic crisis.
Europe finds itself in a precarious position as it appears to be embarking on a military involvement in the situation in the region, risking its vested interests in the Persian Gulf region and its trade connections. In the meantime, the Yemeni resistance fighters are being widely hailed across Muslim countries for adopting effective strategies to pressure Israel to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza.
As the world continues to monitor these developments in the Red Sea, the Yemeni resistance fighters continue to fight to pressure Israel for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City.
The world's largest humanitarian network mobilized to alleviate the suffering of the people of Gaza under incessant Israeli attacks. Iran's Red Crescent Society, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies, and a number of other international organizations are now joining hands to provide assistance and deliver aid shipments to Gaza, a process that has been hindered over the past 3 months due to the Zionist regime's total disrespect for any kind of international law, including the Geneva Conventions.
The main obstacle we are facing right now for the aid in Gaza is the lack of respect of international humanitarian law, the law that is the law during war. And this law has to be respected by all the parties in this conflict, and this we do not see on the ground. Secondly, we need, of course, access. We need better and more reliable, sustained access into Gaza and within Gaza. In order, that's the third point, to increase and scale up humanitarian assistance to the Strip. Right now, it's by far not sufficient what can go into the Strip for this population that is in desperate need of all the items. We need more crossing point, we need regular supply lines, and we need a procedure that allows humanitarian assistance at scale.
Over 24 delegates representing regional divisions of relief organizations operating in conflict zones such as Doctors Without Borders and UNICEF, as well as the ICRC and IRCS, took part in the conference, hoping to find practical measures to help the people of Gaza.
The most important thing is the humanitarian diplomacy, because nothing in the world is more effective than people sitting down and discussing and talking and to come to solutions in which the affected people can find assistance.
In this such a conference, parallel to what we see all around the world, the demonstrations of millions of the people who are arising. We have not seen throughout the history that 300,000, 400,000 people come in London and support the Palestinians, more than a million people in the United States. So what we believe that if we held such a conferences in different countries, which is the first one in Iran, we can put some sorts of pressures on the governments that they also make a move to try to solve an end to this catastrophe which is happening in Gaza.
So far, a substantial amount of humanitarian aid, including medicine, food, and tents weighing 10,000 tons, has been provided by Iran and is ready to be dispatched to Gaza.
Setting up an international fund and also establishing routes into Gaza to assist the civilians in need are among the most important decisions made during this conference. Hisham Shahmari, Tehran.
A solemn funeral procession has been held at the Sayyida Ruqayya Shrine in the heart of the Syrian capital, Damascus. The procession was held for the five Iranian military advisors who were martyred in an Israeli attack on the residential neighborhood of Mazeh. Many people attended the funeral, including religious figures and pilgrims from various countries who affirmed that martyrdom paves the way to victory over the enemies.
The path of martyrdom will culminate in victory, despite the enemy's will. We will emerge triumphant, forcing the enemy out of our land. Operation Al-Aqsa Flood will sweep the enemy away. Through solidarity in the resistance front, from Islamic Iran to Hezbollah in Lebanon, the popular mobilization forces in Iraq, and the heroic Houthis in Yemen, along with our Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance.
We came to visit the shrine of Sayyida Ruqayya and attended the funeral of Iranian and Syrian martyrs. We are all united as Wenixes from southern Lebanon to Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and we will not fear or weaken, no matter the sacrifices.
With great pride, honor, and faith in martyrdom, the funeral procession arrived at the Sayyida Zainab Shrine, peace be upon her, for prayers over the martyrs' bodies. Participants emphasized that the enemy's atrocities cannot intimidate them or deter them from continuing on the path of resistance until victory is achieved with the blessing of the martyrs' blood. Iran's charge of affairs affirmed that there will be a response to the Israeli crime.
Once again, the Zionist entity, through its aggression, violates Syrian sovereignty and targets a building housing Iranian advisors in Damascus. Today, as we participate in the funeral ceremonies of these great martyrs, we affirm to the Zionist entity that this crime will not go unpunished, as the Islamic Republic of Iran has reiterated, we will not forget our martyrs, and the Zionist entity will face retaliation from the axis of resistance.
These are sacrifices made by the heroes of the popular mobilization forces in Iraq, as well as the resistance in Syria and Iran. These are martyrs who give their lives for the resistance front. This is the path of our martyrs and Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. This aggression exposes the enemy's setbacks in Syria and in Gaza, which has driven them to commit these crimes.
The mourners carried the coffins of the martyrs with a mix of sadness and anger, chanting slogans demanding revenge and punishment. They affirmed their readiness to go all the way on the path of liberating Al-Quds and all occupied territories, no matter how great the sacrifices may be. They expressed confidence in the capabilities of the Axis of Resistance and the wisdom of its leadership. Once again, Syrian and Iranian blood mixed to water the land of Damascus as a result of an Israeli criminal attack. And once again, we see Syrians and Iranians united more than ever and determined to defeat the Zionist regime. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
True to their word, they have done it again. Thousands, on foot or by bike, have thronged the streets of Birmingham to say this.
We are riding for Palestine. We want a ceasefire now.
People and children are being killed in Gaza, which is completely unacceptable.
Stop murdering children and innocent people.
In the run-up to today's protest, activists glued shut a branch of London-headquartered banking giant Barclays in Birmingham for allegedly investing in Israeli weapons manufacturers.
I think a lot of people are now fed up by carrying out totally non-violent, non-interactive events, and now they're taking a proactive step so that they get noticed. And this is desperation. And in a one way, it's showing the great crisis that we face in this country. That when the public wants the government to call for a ceasefire, yet our politicians are not listening to the majority of the British public.
Britain's support for apartheid Israel takes many shapes. Visiting Tel Aviv in mid-October last year, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak stood next to his Israeli counterpart Benjamin Netanyahu and said this.
As your friend, we will stand with you in solidarity, we will stand with your people, and we also want you to win.
Prime Minister!
Whatever a win might look like for apartheid Israel, Sunak's Conservative Party and the opposition Labour Party, whose leader Keir Starmer has also backed Netanyahu's war, have both lost voters like Karen, a lawyer.
I feel like we've been massively let down by all governments, all parties across the board, and I've completely lost all faith in all of them.
One group that say the UK position on the US-Israeli genocide in Gaza has completely alienated them are British Muslims, who constitute nearly 7% of the population.
We feel that the people that we have elected to represent us in the corridors of power have become a bunch of yes men. They are saying, yes, sir, three bags full, sir, maybe because they are afraid to lose their careers. This is how bad it's become.
Disappointed with the government and the political establishment, it is in the streets of Britain where people see the future of pro-Palestine solidarity in the UK as they hope for peace that couldn't come a minute too soon. Saeed Pourreza, Birmingham.
Once again, the Israeli regime launched an aerial attack against Syria, targeting a residential area in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Several Syrian troops and at least five Iranian military advisors were martyred, according to an IRGC statement. Military experts say that these acts are clear evidence of Israel's failure in Gaza.
The repeated attacks by the Zionist entity on residential areas indicates that this entity is internally troubled due to its failure to control the Gaza Strip. Therefore, the occupation regime is attempting to export its crises to the region and drag it into a regional war.
Today's aggression on the capital, Damascus, and the targeting of Iranian figures violates international laws and norms because they are present in Syria at the official request of the sovereign Syrian government. It is within the rights of the Syrian government to seek the assistance of advisers to combat terrorism, just like any other country in the world.
At least seven bodies were retrieved from under the rubble of the three-story residential building, which was within a street full of diplomatic missions. Syrian civilians, political figures, and popular media have all denounced this criminal aggression that demonstrates the savage nature of the Zionist regime. They said that such terrorist acts would not intimidate the resistance front.
This is very ugly, worse than you can imagine. I live here nearby. I heard huge explosions in my neighbor's building. A lot of glass was broken. Vehicles were destroyed. And when I went outside to see what had happened, I found a three-story building completely destroyed. This has frightened all the residents in this street. Children were crying in fear and women were screaming. My neighbor is sick and didn't know what to do.
Israelis have failed in Gaza, so they have gone crazy and are firing in any direction to make it clear that they are present. But they will not succeed because the axis of resistance is resilient. I was less than 100 meters away when the explosion occurred. May God bless the souls of the martyrs.
Late last month, the Israeli regime assassinated a senior Iranian advisor, General Sayed Rassi Mousavi, in a missile strike that targeted his house in the vicinity of Sayyida Zainab Shrine south of Damascus.
The Israeli regime is trying to intimidate the peoples of the region and is pushing to escalation through assassinations and terrorist attacks in the region. But people insist that they will never be afraid of the apartheid regime. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Thousands of Yemenis have filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities to slam the US blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement. The protesters also expressed their continuous support for the Yemeni army's operations in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden.
We came here today in Sabin Square to send a big message to the Sahyuni, Israeli and American and British. We have a good weapon to make you under the sea, not under the ground, under the sea.
The Yemeni people and the whole world know who America is. Its entire history is full of terrorism, murder, crime, corruption, support for criminals and the production of weapons for more killing. There is nothing clearer than the crimes committed by Israel and America in the Gaza Strip, with no less than 240 martyrs every day, not to mention the wounded and the missing. Therefore, for America to classify any group in the world as terrorist is very silly and it cannot be believed by a rational person.
Officials say the recent U.S. move is in line with Washington's support for the Israeli regime and its atrocities in Gaza. They say the U.S. is endangering the region to protect the Israeli regime, which clearly exemplifies terrorism.
It's a great honor for us that the sponsor and founder of terrorism, which has killed countless people around the world and used its atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and killed hundreds of thousands there, is the one that classified us as terrorists. But we represent the most honorable position from a moral and humanitarian standpoint. America's recent designation is in line with its support for the Israeli genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. We stand with Palestine and will not back down from this position.
In response to the Yemeni army's relentless attacks against Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea, the U.S. has announced the redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group. The group has been stepping up its military operations against American and British ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. The U.S. and U.K. launched attacks on Yemen following its move to target Israeli-linked ships in retaliation for the regime's genocide in Gaza.
Despite the strikes by the U.S. and the U.K., people have gathered here to prove their point. They say they are not afraid of a new war and are ready for all options. They also believe that the US is the godfather of terrorism and has no right to designate any of the resistance movements as a terrorist group. Avlatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Placed in Italy's wealthy northeast, Vicenza is known for being the country's capital of gold and for an international gold and jewelry industry fair, which has been running for 70 years. This year's edition has seen a number of anti-Israel initiatives organized across the city. On Friday, a protest was held in the vicinity of the trade fair premises in protest to Tel Aviv's massacres against the civilians in Gaza. Israel, one of the diamond world's leading centers, occupied an entire pavilion for its dealers at the jewelry boutique showcase.
Israel's diamond exports have increased even in the past months, even when the regime is committing a genocide against the Palestinians. Israel's diamonds are drenched in blood. Tel Aviv steals the precious gems from African countries such as Congo, Sudan, and Ivory Coast, using children as the easiest source of cheap labor.
Protesters outside Vicenza's jewelry industry fair are saying that most people don't know that the diamond industry is a main source of funding for the Israeli military. They argue that Israeli blood diamonds have bankrolled the mass murder of over 24,000 Gazans since early October, most of whom were women and children. Vicenza has been hosting rallies in response to Israeli jewelry dealers participating in its international gold fair for nearly two decades.
Noi contestiamo questa presenza.
We are against having the Israelis at the Vicenza gold fair. It's immoral for everybody and mostly for our city. Doing business with a country that is standing before the International Court of Justice is dishonorable. A country that is committing genocide now, as we speak. What's the difference between our deaths and the Ukrainian deaths?
Also on Friday, a public assembly was held in central Vicenza. The initiative was attended, among the others, by Italian healthcare workers who were in Gaza during the bombing carried out by Israeli regime in the past months. On Saturday, Vicenza will also host a rally in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians. Max Civili, Vicenza.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
More than 100 days in, U.S. President Joe Biden's unwavering commitment to the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza has so far cost the lives of more than 24,000 Palestinians, put the integrity of international law into test. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Biden has firmly positioned himself as a full partner to the Zionist regime's military campaign, despite acknowledging more than once the indiscriminate nature of its bombing in Gaza, essentially admitting to aiding and abetting war crimes. Accordingly, Biden and his secretaries of state and defense are being sued for their failure to prevent the genocide and their complicity in the genocide unfolding in Gaza. The Biden administration's no daylight, unconditional support for the Zionist regime has provided so much leeway that Tel Aviv regime has no way of climbing down from its stated war objectives despite having achieved none. No victory is on the horizon for the Zionist regime, to say the least. The United States is putting itself in a similarly intractable position as it lobs bombs in a regional tinderbox, setting off a series of consequences that it will find increasingly difficult to control. Washington is now bombing Yemen, despite acknowledging doing so has little deterrent effect. After the US and UK launched airstrikes across the country recently following an alleged missile and drone attack in the direction of an American embargo ship and Navy vessel surrounding it days earlier. The Biden regime claims that the U.S. is not interested in a war with Yemen, as White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby said recently. The New York Times asked that same day, "The regional war no one wanted is here. How wide will it get?" The answer depends on how long the U.S. regime prolongs the genocide in Gaza, as the regional escalations are a direct result of Washington's morally and strategically disastrous policy. The U.S.-UK airstrikes in Yemen were launched on the first day of the genocide hearings at the International Court of Justice at The Hague recently. The U.S. regime opposes those proceedings. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrogantly dismissed South Africa's genocide complaint. Washington opposes any effective measure to hold the Zionist regime accountable, just as it opposes even efforts towards securing a ceasefire, repeatedly preventing the U.N. Security Council from issuing a legally binding call for one. Biden's regional predicament is one of his own making, as he has inserted himself as a full partner to the Zionist regime's genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. His administration's support for the Zionist regime's military campaign, now surpassing 100 days, has resulted in hostilities between the Zionist regime and other countries that are on the brink of a full-scale war. Washington's material and diplomatic support for the genocidal campaign in Gaza has invited attacks on American targets in different countries, where U.S. strikes on January 4th raised the ire of the country's government. And now the U.S. regime is engaged in a direct military confrontation with Ansarullah, which has for weeks maintained a naval blockade to prevent commercial ships from reaching Israeli ports. Ansarullah of Yemen has made clear that its intervention in the Red Sea is aimed at exacting an economic cost on the child killer regime of Israel for the genocide in Gaza, a form of pressure to bring the bloodshed and humanitarian catastrophe to an end. Yemen's solidarity with Gaza is compelled by its own experience of foreign military occupation and a starvation born of blockade and being subjected to a years-long air campaign backed by Washington and London. Surely Ansarullah and its supporters see the fates of Palestinians in Gaza and people in Yemen as intertwined, and that taking action to curtail the genocide in Gaza also serves to protect Yemen's own long-term security. Ansarullah's objective is in direct contradiction to the U.S. policy of prolonging the war and shielding the Zionist regime from any meaningful pressure to end it. Mohammad al-Bukhaiti, a member of the political wing of Ansarullah, said before the US-UK airstrikes on Yemen, his group had targeted only ships leading towards Israeli ports or owned by Zionist entities. Al-Bukhaiti added that the goal wasn't to sink or seize the vessels, but to cause them to reroute and thus provide a means of applying economic pressure on the child killer regime of Israel. The Yemeni attacks on shipping have resulted in no reports of injuries or fatalities, unlike the deadly US and UK airstrikes on Yemen. Al-Bukhaiti said that the US British airstrikes have set new and permanent rules of engagement in the Red Sea. Al-Bukhaiti said, "This is the moment we have been waiting for, that the battle is directly between us and America and Britain." He added that the world now sees clearly the two sides, Yemen, which is bravely trying to stop this genocide in Gaza, and America, Britain, who are protecting the perpetrators. Recently, Yahya Sari, the spokesperson for the Yemeni armed forces, said that all American and British ships and warships involved in the aggression against our country are considered hostile targets by the Yemeni armed forces. He reiterated that the blockade on Israeli navigation would continue until the aggression stops and the siege on the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip is lifted. Those resistance forces are an indigenous response to foreign occupation and war, either imposed or backed by the US regime. With those resistance groups at a stage of maturation, no longer can the child killer regime of Israel, armed and shielded by Washington and London, do whatever it wants to the Palestinians without incurring a cost to both itself and its chief benefactor. The genocide in Gaza is strengthening the belief in the region that resistance is imperative, not just as a deterrent to the existential threat posed by the fabricated regime of Israel, but as the only realistic path to liberation, sovereignty, and self-determination.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Well, this is IRIB English Radio and...
And you're listening to Youth Station.
Yes, once more we're back to home.
Yeah. Home. And I am Bita.
I'm Asma. And once again, we're here to have a beautiful discussion.
Yeah, and it's a pleasure, really, to
of
be
course.
Here.
How are you, Bita?
I'm doing well, mm-hmm. and I'm busy with my exams and so on.
So, commitment is something that
scary,
is...
Scary, isn't it?
Why? Because I said it in a scary way
no,
or totally...
it is scary.
It like
itself
scary.
In a big
yeah,
way.
It is scary.
You know, when you're committed to something, it is like you're trapped in somewhere. You cannot... You know, you're not free anymore.
I feel whenever yeah. the word commitment comes... I feel like I'm no longer having any wings.
Exactly.
It's just the fact that you have to go by rules. You cannot put your foot one step away from
yeah.
the borders. It's just borders.
And let me complete your examples. They cut your wings,
uh-huh.
but at the same time, you can look at the blue sky.
Oh my, yeah.
And this is the difficult part that
Thank
you have
you.
The opportunity.
Thank you very much for mentioning it.
Yeah, but you cannot use it because
yeah.
you are committed.
So the wings are not cut. You have the wings.
Yeah, they maybe
you
tied them up.
You have those wings of desire. You have the blue sky upon
yeah.
your head. The only thing that has happened is that it's just like a prison. There are walls around you.
Yeah.
And there's also glass above your head because maybe there are some youngsters who would say, okay, you have wings, fly. So that's our first impression of commitment, but...
Which is bad. I mean,
which is
if
bad.
You ask someone older, like, for example, 60 years old, their answer would be completely different, I bet.
Yeah, they have a good perspective of commitment. They like, look at it totally differently.
Yeah, commitment means love, means the passion that you have for someone.
Commitment and means that
it's something but positive.
Special rules that are going to benefit you and your loved ones. And it's going to make you more productive.
Because and more it's close going, to each other.
Yeah. And it's giving you directions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's that, the difference between now, the definitions.
Vita, you know, ever since I've been to university, I just come to analyze many things. Like, my thoughts are totally changed about some specific concepts. One of those concepts is... commitment. Like, when I look at my classmates, my colleagues, I would see that, okay, they have no commitment to their major.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I love literature with my heart. Whenever anybody comes sits beside me in the class, in literary classes, I expect them to be as committed as I am.
Like, I know what
you
mean.
If anybody comes to me, you know, there is a never-ending war between the students of teaching and the students of literature. It's not war, actually. It's just, you know, there's something.
Yeah.
There's something. So I never think about changing my major. I never think about going for another stuff.
I get it.
To spend my time with. But when others do that, I come to wonder how committed they are to their major. I know it's not a holy verse that cannot be changed. It's just a major. You can't change it.
But I get
you know what
feeling.
I feel? I had that idea of being protective, being committed toward that major even that I love so much.
You know, the first point I have to clarify is that commitment is not always about people. You're not always committed to relationships or people.
Exactly.
Most of the time, you're committed to your own goals, to your own situation, to your own thoughts. Exactly. And the same thing happens to me whenever I go to university, because my major is the major of dealing with the life of people.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't study well, one patient is going to die in the future.
Exactly.
Okay. So, the problem I see in the university is always that people just jerking around, playing, going out, hanging around.
They don't take it seriously.
And come on, what are you doing? Yeah. You don't have enough time.
Mm-hmm.
And this feeling of lack of commitment in my generation always bothers me.
So why today's generation? Well, we are part of them, but we're just saying our own problems. Why do we feel scared of commitment?
I think we have to keep the answer of this question after a break.
So nice. Let's go for that break. Welcome back. This is Youth Station. We are talking about commitment. Why being committed is that scary?
Yeah, and that difficult, by
and
the
that
way.
Difficult.
You know, first of all, I think our generation is not used. Our generation actually doesn't get used to difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have everything ready. We have our home, our phone, our food, whatever we want at the time that we want it. And because of that, we didn't learn. And for beautiful outcomes, we have to work hard. We have to struggle.
Yeah.
We have to do something at least. And because of lack of these mindsets, it's really difficult for us to understand even people that have commitment, you know. And another thing is lack of passion. When you don't like something, you don't see the necessity to be committed to that thing.
Yeah, that is one point. And the other point is the side effects of being committed.
What do you mean?
Like, for example, when you are committed to a family, there are some side effects to that. Like, for example, I'm just giving you an example because everything is happening like spontaneously right in here. For example, you cannot do whatever that comes to your mind.
You lose so many opportunities because of your commitment, maybe.
Let's don't put it that way. Fun.
Yeah,
fun
you cannot hang out with your friends because you have to hang out with your family.
See, the rules are not set by you.
I know.
For commitments, there are some universal rules. Everybody knows the rules, and then you just have to go by it. The difficulty is to submit yourself to those rules. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just because we talked about it, with commitments comes the rules. With those rules comes the submission to those rules. So being committed means that you have a certain amount of submission to the kind of rules. Now, if it's for a major you have, for the job you have, people might relate to that more easily.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the family commitments, it becomes difficult and sort of, you know...
Because you're not father or mother, or so, for example, you can understand the commitment between parents and children.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is the same story here. And this commitment, it calls to actually responsibility. Mm-hmm. When you are committed to something, you are responsible for that thing.
That's the point. That is the thing that makes it scary. With commitment comes the submission and, of course, responsibilities. Yeah. So it's not just that you abide by the rules, no. You have to have some responsibilities as well. So this is the thing that scares most of us, and that's why we escape from commitments.
And another thing is that I believe that in the past, people were more kind of extrovert. They tend to communicate with other people, be connected to them, mm-hmm. talk to them, take responsibility of other people. But nowadays, we are more isolated. We feel like our loneliness is a blessing.
When you say loneliness, it has a negative
solitude.
Point. Yeah, but then there's another thing.
Yeah.
You know, in past, people taking in too much of difficulties, they said no. But right now, it's very easy for us to say no.
Like, is it something bad? I don't think so.
I think in some cases, it's not such a good thing. Like for example, look at the children who have got families that have been distorted, like with divorce. If you go mm-hmm. and ask them, is it good to say no very quickly? They would tell you, no, it's not good to say no very easily.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I
mean, like in past, people used to fight for things more and more. But right now, whenever we have a difficult situation, we tend to cut the rope at that moment.
I see that a lot. And, you know, I think because the boundaries are not true nowadays, because we feel like we have so many options. We feel like we have so many choices. Even for choosing a friend, we feel like, okay, I go on Instagram, I post something.
Exactly. Yeah. This one is gone, the other one comes.
Exactly. And this mindset will actually trigger the feeling of running away from commitment.
Exactly. Yeah. So why do I have to bother myself committing to something that I know I don't like to commit myself to it? Like, life is going to be more difficult. It's a fact.
Yeah.
There's no way to ignore it. Like, when you commit to something, as you just said, there are responsibilities. With responsibilities comes difficulty. Sometimes you're not in the mood.
This commitment is not one-sided. I mean, when you are committed to someone, that other person, that other thing mm-hmm. is committed to you.
I can hear the toll of the break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
I am one of those people who is scared of commitment as well. But not all sorts of commitments. There are some commitments that are worthy of committing yourself to them.
Yeah.
It's better for me to rephrase it and put it this way, that I don't see the commitment that is worth committing yourself to it.
I get what you mean. So I have a different point of view. I feel like commitment is something necessary for you. Mm-hmm. Commitment is a way of sacrificing, and you need sacrifice in order to prove your value to yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you have to prioritize
how commitment
everything.
Is a way of sacrifice.
You know, because when you are committed to something, you're sacrificing something else, some commitment, some other commitment.
Yourself, that is
exactly.
Your selfishness.
And yourself. Mm-hmm. I don't call it selfishness, you know, because it's your personal choice. I mean, you want to spend time with yourself. Then
because
it's
if, you
not
don't
called
sacrifices, if you don't sacrifice, yeah. You know, simply I call it selfishness because if you don't sacrifice, then you are going to be accused of being selfish.
But you're not.
But you're not. It was yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Trust
exactly.
Issue would make commitment so difficult.
Difficult. Because you feel like that there should be something that deserves this commitment.
That's what I was talking about. Yeah. The worthy committee that you would love to commit yourself to it, nowadays seems to be rare.
It is.
Or at least it's not that. And the only one school of thought that is always right and there'd be no sort of criticism applicable to it is the commitment that you have with Allah. And all
exactly.
The narrations of the Holy Prophet and his companion, of course. So, yeah, the only commitment that is worth standing for, that is worth submitting to, is the connection and commitment to Allah, the Almighty.
It is. And the last thing I want to add up to our conversation here at Eustation is that the honey for making it more sweet, making this difficult road softer, is the love that you have for Allah Almighty and the faith that you
exactly.
Are trying to grow.
So if I want to say the gist of today's episode, I would put
yeah.
It this way, that there is no one who could say that, okay, commitment does not have any difficulty, commitment is a very easy thing, is a very sweet stuff to go for. No, commitment has got side effects. You have to have responsibilities, you have to accept those responsibilities, and you have to abide by the rules. And at the same time, you have to submit yourself to all the rules. So it does not seem, at least it does not seem very easy, but then the love that you talked about is going to change the whole story.
Exactly.
Like you find out a committee that is worth standing for, that is worth fighting for. So not all the commitments are sort of scary. Some of them would develop you. Some of them would help you grow more and more. And they would add to your maturity. It's not a good way to forget about all the good things that come out of commitment just because you were scared of that wings of desire to
exactly.
Be caught down.
I believe there is a lot to talk about these commitments and the stories. But we are running out of time,
yeah.
And as you know, time flies.
Unfortunately.
So I think we have to say goodbye, start your listeners. I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings. Be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
we'll discuss
this
that,
in
inshallah,
the
in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif, 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 Ya Latif.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.